I'm Laura Harper Lake.
And I'm Sarah Reitzman, and you're listening to Creative Guts. Hey friends, thanks for tuning in to Creative Guts.
Today we're talking with Brian Paul of Dorks and Dungeons. In addition to performing in and directing improv comedy shows for over 15 years, Brian is also a writer, which I'm very interested to know more about. I've seen him perform, and he is very talented as a GM or a DM in the Dorks and Dungeons scene, which you're going to hear a lot more about.
We're excited to talk with Brian about all of the above that he does, so let's jump right into this episode of Creative Guts with Brian Paul.
Hi, Brian Paul. Thanks for being on the Creative Guts show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
I'm already ruining the episode. Do you get any man with two first names jokes?
Since birth. The only response is I have three because I have a middle name.
What's your middle name?
Edward.
Wouldn't it be funny if your middle name was Smith?
I guess.
Or like a last name.
You know, that is, I don't know that in all my years I've had that as the response to my response. So point for you.
The man with three first names.
Yep.
So let's dig into you as a creative. What exactly do you do as a creative, and when did you start?
Let's see. What do I do? I try a lot of different things, I guess. Mostly, I think I'm known as an improviser and various storytelling type creative activities. I've done playwriting and other kinds of creative writing, but the one that is probably most visible to the public is my improv work. I got started in improv specifically as sort of a focused activity, not as just, I mean, I guess everyone does it. So, you know, from birth, but in high school, I want to say like my junior year or so, I was doing a play because I wanted to try it. So I auditioned. Nobody had heard of me. I had just been doing technical theater, but I had not done any performance. And through performing, I met the drama club that met before rehearsals, because after school, I didn't have anywhere to be. So I would just hang around the theater doing homework or reading. And that is what introduced me to improvisational theater as a focused, like there is a dedicated skill set to learn separate from other acting and performing and music type performance things. And I had been watching, I think as many a young improviser, watching like Whose Line Is It Anyway was, yeah, you know, coming on comedy. Comedy Central
My
after school.
Favorite TV show.
Yeah. Loved that.
So I had seen that and was familiar with that. And I just, as a anxious person, it wasn't something that I thought I would do, but they invited me to try it. I dove in and was like, this is really enjoyable. And it became an obsession.
This probably is not an uncommon first reaction, but my like gut instinct is to be like, but isn't it scary? Were you just like, you just kind of like got over it? Were you born fearless, or does it take practice?
No. Like... I'm a fearful person. I'm a fearful person for sure. Or anxious person, call it what you want. But I've at various points, I have done things specifically to confront a fear or, you know, something that gave me anxiety and just go, well, I'm going to try it. And sometimes it's not fun and I don't do it again. And sometimes you find out that it's enjoyable and it's actually a way to cope or, you know, work through the thing, that discomfort. And then you have a tool in your toolbox to deal with that. And that was probably a big motivator for doing it, because improv is a way to access, like a lot of people will call it like, you know, flow state or, you know, all those kinds of things of like being in a creative mindset where you're not really thinking about what you're doing. You're just doing this thing you know how to do. And there are lots of different ways to get there and access that. It's a pleasant mental space. And so I found that that is what it does for me. You know, I can get to a pleasant mental space, and then all of those worries about, you know, fear or anxiety or any of those things are just put aside. You don't have time to be concerned with it. And that if that starts creeping back in, you just, you know, dive into the work more. You keep going. So
do you ever screw up, or is that kind of the beauty of improv that everything goes?
I guess the beauty is that the mistakes are all made intentional. you know, there are different ideas and things and people bouncing around inside this idea space. And inevitably, someone misunderstands, mishears, and the audience may never even realize that there was a mistake made because you just reincorporate it. You just fold it back in. And, you know, does a painter ever misplace their brush? And then the final product, you would never know, right? They make
what
it.
What a great way to phrase it. Absolutely.
You know, it's like if you look at someone's painting, you're not going, that brush stroke is out of place. You know, they worked it in. They covered it up, or they made it all part of the final product. And improv, you do the same thing. If you're at, you know, it doesn't always work, you know, makes mistakes, you learn. But that's the goal, is that, yeah, you make mistakes, but it doesn't matter. Hopefully you're not making intentional, you know, derailing mistakes, right? That's, of course, a different thing that sometimes people will phone it in.
Or Michael Scott in The Office and his improv.
Right. If you study improv, he is derailing. Which he, you know, the, what's that actor's name? Steve guy.
Steve Carell.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Right. He's a very proficient improviser. So yeah, that scene is about him doing everything wrong.
Yeah.
And how even if you do everything wrong, in the larger context of them all working together for that larger scene, it works.
Yeah.
But like the scene within the scene is a disaster. So you can make any mistake work.
With improv, I associate that almost universally with comedy. Is that always the case?
No, but it's largely the case. Mm-hmm. I'm aware that some groups do use improv for more dramatic purposes, but that I think a lot of the organizations, is maybe the better word, that have popularized improv as an entertainment style have leaned on comedy and really developed the methods of comedy. And that's why you see that a lot. But at the heart of it, you can study it as a storytelling method. And so if you wanted to tell a serious dramatic story, you could. I just think that not a lot of people want to go out and go, this is going to be some kind of serious story, I don't know, but come out and see some improvisers do it, and they're going to go, I don't know if I'm into that. But you're like, they're just going to be really ridiculous and funny. You're like, that's a genre, right? I like. And it's like, is that a genre even, really? I guess it is.
Yeah, because the payoff can be the comedy rather than the climax and conclusion of a story.
Yeah, right. I have done plenty of long form shows where it was a great story and it wasn't just all for kicks. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if the story is terrible, but you had some laughs, then, well, we forgive you for having a terrible story. Yeah, it works in Hollywood, right?
Right.
Terrible story, but hey, those guys are pretty funny. So
what do you mean when you say study improv?
So there's a lot of folks who have studied it as like a theoretical, you know, thing, in the same way that they study acting theory. And there's different schools of acting methods, and there's different schools of, I assume, visual artists. And, you know, I'm not familiar with that, but you sort of pick a discipline of within the larger thing and you study that. And so for improv, it's a newer art form, but there are different books and schools and things like that where it's been studied. And so to study it is to look at the literature, I guess, and find which author, or usually they're more like a director or a coach, but like whose line of thought works for you. And you try to internalize those strategies and then put them into practice. And then studying it is also doing the time of just doing a lot of scene work, you know, just perform. And even if you're just at like a rehearsal type setting, you just got to do it over and over again, right? Until you've honed the technique. That's what studying it is. Cause it's, it just looks like walking and talking. And so don't think it takes a lot to learn. And that's, of course, not fair. That'd be like saying that Olympic marathon runners are like, yeah, I can move my feet, whatever. I'm super not impressed with you guys running a long way. I could do that, right? It's like,
you
that's not.
You just start running and you then just, you don't stop.
And then you just don't stop, whatever, right? That's not fair to them, you know? And so I think that to say like, oh, I studied improv, it's like, why? Why? You go around talking to people all day. What's the point? What do you mean you got to study that? You know, and it's all the subtle layers underneath what the surface activity is what you're studying.
So one thing I can think of as far as improv, though not with an audience necessarily, though sometimes, where it's not always comedy is role-playing in tabletop RPG campaigns, which I do twice a week. And so that's sort of the realm of improv that I know without automatic comedy. But then my first introduction to you was Dorks and Dungeons, which is very similar, except in a more presentation, less table sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to tell us about Dorks and Dungeons?
Yeah.
What a stellar segue, Laura.
Thanks.
Super. Awesome. You guys know what you're doing. So Dorks and Dungeons is the merging of improvisational theater with the tropes and I want to say the artifacts and tools of role-playing games. And when the show was being conceived, I had done a similar type of show in Improv Boston, but theirs was less focused on the trappings of the game, with dice and character sheets and the things that kind of anchored you in the idea that this was a tabletop game.
Mm-hmm.
And that was much more just improvisers doing scenes, and there were the heroes and there was a GM and there were the pit of improvisers, but that everything else was just improv. There was no other tools. And so this was conceived as like, let's just do the basics of playing a role-playing game on stage. And at first it was just that, and it was terrible in its implementation, but showed that there was merit to keep retaining a lot of those trappings and trying to find the right balance of how much do we keep to still call ourselves like doing this tabletop type thing, but how much can we shed it away to focus on just doing good improv.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's Dorks and Dungeons that is seen now is the evolution of kind of iterating through, like, let's get rid of more, let's get rid of more, let's bring a little back, let's get rid of this, let's bring this in. And how many different ways can we take these little blocks and build them into something and keep it fun for us and the audience?
It has a really good balance, seeing it on, you know, after all of that work. You know, I've been going for the last year or two on and off, and I'm in that world and I get it, and so I understand it because of that. But I've attended with people who aren't necessarily in that world, and they get it and understand it and enjoy it too. So I feel like you've found the right equation for that.
Well, thank you very much. It has been years of work and you know, refinement. Mm-hmm. I think that's the word I want, of sitting down in rehearsals and going, yeah, this just doesn't quite work. Let's not do scenes that way, or let's not roll dice for these things, and let's get rid of this, let's include this. And yeah, it was a very conscious evolution of the format.
And it absolutely sticks with you. Like, my husband and I still make references to the handful of shows that we saw a couple years ago. Jagamemnon,
mm-hmm.
the way he makes that noise, that I can't even do it, but we try to do it all the time because we talk about how amazing he is at sounding like a jaguar. And you know, just all this, you know.
I'll let them know.
It is a highlight in my household. But there's just such a poetry to it, and it is so funny. Our faces hurt after when we leave, you know.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, it's really good. And I also really appreciate how the audience gets involved. Do you want to tell folks about the chip system?
Sure, yeah. So anyone who's been to an improv show is probably familiar with the fact that there's audience participation in some way, and that we experimented with a lot of different ways of involving the audience, and that some of them were hazardous to our health, and some of them introduced too much wait time for the audience to sort of process what we needed them to do. So we've sort of reduced it and refined it down to the reroll token, which is that we allow the audience to dictate when our heroes will reroll their dice, so that they still have a lot of influence on the story and what happens, but that it's in a way that's a little seamless, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it's maybe seamless is not the right, because it is an interruption of what we're doing. But sometimes in other shows, there's a whole like, we're going to get people on stage now, and it's 10 minutes of like getting them up there and having a laugh. And then it's like, and now we're finally back to the show. When you're doing something that is trying to be narratively driven, a 10 minute break in the narrative, and then you get back and go, what were we doing? Why did we care? Why did we bring you on stage? And that's not the audience's fault, you know. That's just the nature of getting someone on stage. You know, if you were at a basketball game, like, hey, you want to come out and shoot some hoops? You know, take 10 minutes to get you out there and everybody settle down to throw the ball around. So, you know, that's why we've done less of that, because mm-hmm. We're concerned with the momentum of the story and not losing the thread of, like, you know, the excitement, the idea that there's raising stakes in this little mini story. So that's why we've reduced a lot of it down to just the audience can throw things at us and make us redo something.
And it's so exciting to see when it happens, because sometimes it'll be, oh, one chip out of left field. Like, someone wanted to have that person re-roll. Sometimes it's like 15 are thrown up at the same time because nobody wants to see that person fail or that person succeed. And it has such an interactive component that's really exciting, but, you know, not too interruptive. And it kind of breaks the fourth wall when the actors are, you know, mm-hmm. like giggling along with it too.
Yeah. Is audience participation sort of traditionally a part of improv?
It almost has to be, because I think part of it is just by tradition that we do it. But the idea that, you know, we need to show the audience that we are generating this from, you know, a random seed, right? That we've got to have that input to then start our randomization engine. And so traditionally, the way to do that, there are shows where, like, all they'll do is at the top of the show, they go, can I get a word from the audience? And people will shout stuff and they'll be like, great, thank you for that word. And they'll do a 30-minute set, you know, and that's pretty much the only input they get from mm-hmm. the audience. And then they do their sort of their format using that to prime the pump. And then they go off and they use that to iterate more ideas. And so that is the, you know, the simplest core. There's way more involved audience participation, scenes and formats and whatnot. But yeah, I think that it's a kind of a necessity. There are other ways you could add a randomization element into the show without using the audience, but it's kind of, well, why not? Rather than us pulling words from a deck of cards,
right?
Just ask someone in the audience.
Right.
And so I think that's why it is a standard practice to involve them somehow. And so for us, and we've done it before, we get ideas from the audience at the top of the show. But yeah, we've really just like, yeah, we're really going to just let you mess with us and to demonstrate that we are improvising, that we don't know where this is going to go. We don't know if this is going to succeed or fail for our protagonists, because the audience is really dictating it, you know, more than anything else. So
it's kind of nice too when it's done in a way that's a little bit low pressure for the audience. You're just yelling stuff from your seat, like I recall in Whose Line, you know, mm-hmm. the audience would yell out locations or something like that, versus say like a Mystery Science Theater 3000 or a Blue Man Group, where like they make you come up on stage mm-hmm. and it's really like, in addition to the waiting time you were talking about before, it's also sort of like scary.
Right. Yeah. I have done, you know, plenty of short form improv, which is the type that you see in like Whose Line Is It Anyway? And some of those, you got to get audience members up on stage and they've got to participate. And, you know, some people don't want to do that. And sometimes the people who do want to do that aren't the people that you want to join you on stage. They have malintent. It's nice that we can do it in a way where even someone who is very shy, you know, you can remain anonymous in the darkness of the theater and just throw things at us. Yeah. And you know, we won't know.
One of my biggest fears is being called out, because that actually happened to me at a comedy show in London. The comedian talked to my friend and I and then said a bunch of terrible things about us as Americans. And it was highly embarrassing and mortifying, I'm getting terrible flashbacks now. I'll move on.
But. Yeah, we used to have a preface before the show that we don't do as much anymore. We were like, if you don't bother us, we won't bother you.
Because
like people were really concerned about coming to our show. They're like, I hear it's improv, so you might harass me. And we were like, we will not harass you if you do not harass us.
Yeah.
And we've had people harass us, and we will be like, okay, well, we are going to come after you now. Like, don't heckle.
That's what you deserve, yeah.
You know, like, you can heckle maybe a stand-up comic. They maybe aren't on their feet enough, right? But if you heckle an improv show, you're the kind of person who must, like, play with fire. You know, like, you're crazy. Don't do that.
I love heckling and being heckled.
Well, if you like it, then come to an improv show.
It gives me high anxiety. Throwing the chip gave me a little anxiety. Like, I'm like, I don't want to, like, throw it at the moment someone's stepping and then they slip on it. And like, I overthink a lot and I worry, but it also is a little thrill. Like, ooh, I did it.
That's such a classic.
We've had people get hit in the head and dinged. And yeah, it's a little ridiculous that we ask people to throw hard objects at us. But
they're small. I mean, a little bit bigger, like a half dollar size.
Yeah, but people really get into it sometimes.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Are they like poker chips?
Yeah.
Okay.
They're like clay poker chips.
So. And there's only so many, right?
Yeah.
So like you want to get there early to get yours. Because I remember I was like the last person, I was like the first person to not get one. And I was in one of the shows so devastated, and I think my husband got it and he was like, here, you can throw it. I'm like, okay.
We have to have some cap on how many we give out or the show would just never end.
It
would just go on forever. And then some people, we don't really know how many are out there because some people will just keep them.
They'll
show up one day at one of our shows, like, I've been coming for years. We're like, that's awesome, great. And then they show us a fistful of tokens, and it's like, why are you using them?
It's
like
Judgment Day.
I'm waiting for the right time. It's like, okay.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
That's a person who likes to be heckled too.
Yeah. And we love those people just as much. You know, that's great. They're like, I want to be in control of this show, and we're like, great, cool.
That's awesome. I'm so in awe of you guys up there. You're all really great performers. You seem to be like a family where you have a good, you know, relationship with each other in that sense. And to what you were saying before, you all have these, you know, this tool belt, these skills. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, do the skills that you learn in improv, I'm guessing you take them out into other parts of your life? I'm thinking public speaking or maybe, I don't want to say negotiating, but, you know, problem solving with other people. Does that kind of help you in other areas?
I think it does. I can't speak for all improvisers. I don't know if it...
But it's helped you.
I've read, like, Keith Johnstone was an early person who helped develop what we have as, like, modern improv terms and theory and whatnot. And his first book is a little bit freewheeling and crazy because he was breaking new ground. But he has a great section about how people speak to each other, and there's a lot of hidden status exchanges. And at the point of what he's getting at is how you can use that to drive a scene. And that if you have a status and you view somebody else another status, that creates a recognizable and understandable relationship between the two characters. And that humor can come from a disparity between how someone sees you and how you see them. And that people will go, wow, that's so relatable. This is so funny. And that this all comes from the fact that people actually talk like that. And so I got a lot out of that because you can recognize someone's intent in how they speak, or you can recognize maybe some personality traits of how they're making a status exchange with you. You're like, oh, they're talking down to me. They're not outright saying I'm better than you, but that they do it with how they speak. And you like learn to recognize that, and you recognize that some people want to be elevated in their status. So you talk to them in a way that just goes, here, I'm going to affirm that thing you want to hear. And we are all programmed to do this. Maybe not programmed, but we've learned to do it in socializing in our daily lives. But once you've like recognized how people talk, you're now aware of the subtext more than you were before. Like, you're aware of the subtext, but you're not consciously aware of the subtext. And so improv has benefited me in recognizing, oh, this person is playing super low status. They are very uncomfortable with something, or they do not think of themselves as somebody worthy of whatever this interaction is. And recognizing that, you can go, oh, they're wrong, I should lift them up. Or, you know what, this will be easier if I just acquiesce to acknowledging that they are low status, right? That sometimes people just want you to acknowledge the status they want to have. And once you kind of internalize how that exchange happens, you can make people happy, or you can, you know, undermine someone and they won't understand why, because you're making small status exchanges that are the opposite of what they want. They're like, something seems off. And they're going to keep pushing this point that you're aware that is a stupid point, but you're just like, I'm playing you right now and you don't realize it. That makes it sound super manipulative, but
you're basically a Bond villain.
I'm basically a Bond villain. Yeah. But that's how I think improv can help us understand how we are either like positive or toxic towards each other without being on purpose. Sometimes it's purposeful and you're like, oh, that's a terrible thing to do. But there's a lot of little things that we do and how to go, I shouldn't do that, I should do this. Stuff like that. That's what I think like the subtle benefit of studying these things has had.
What an interesting lesson in like psychology that made me think of, did you watch that show Lie to Me? It was Tim Roth, and he could like tell when people are lying based on like teeny little cues that they were giving off.
I'm watching, rewatching Psych right now, which is very similar, and you know, he can read people that way. So I was literally thinking that too.
Like you've unlocked a power of observation that other people don't necessarily have.
It makes me want to do it against myself. Like, am I a bit of an or am I a good person?
Were you worried that Brian was judging us? Because I was.
Yeah.
I was like, what am I giving off? What's my status? Shit.
It's a thing that we don't realize that we do, that we are all doing it.
Yeah.
You know, like it's really interesting. And I don't know that it's the golden key or anything, but just studying improv, you have to learn how people interact with each other to make your scenes more immediately relatable. And that actors are, you know, like a traditional actor is more worried about like showing a genuine emotion or like this fully realized character because somebody else has already thought out the words and figured out what those status dynamics and exchanges of the dialogue are. And an actor brings a lot to that in tone and things like that. They can mess with the words. But as an improviser, you need to shortcut all of that and go, this is how people talk to each other. And if I get that right, my acting, you can be more forgiving in that I'm not, you know, A-plus actor because I'm also playing a writer. I'm also doing this other thing. So that's why the emphasis on skills and knowledge are different between the two. That's, I think, an important distinction.
That's such a cool answer. That's so much more than what I was thinking when I asked the question.
Right?
Which is awesome. That's really good.
I'm glad I could provide you with a good answer.
The rest have been terrible, but that one was good.
I appreciate your honesty.
No, you're very good at this. Have you like improvised before?
I have, yes.
Are you improvising right now?
Yes, I am. We all are. Isn't it amazing? It's amazing.
Side question, do you play tabletop RPG games? Like, do you play D&D or Pathfinder?
No, not anymore. I started doing tabletop role-playing games a few years before I really started doing improv, so it's a little bit longer. I have played plenty of D&D, haven't done Pathfinder, but they're one and the same.
Yes.
I played my most recent D&D game has been over for a couple of years. We did like a 5-year game where we went all the way back to Advanced Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, wow.
Because my friend wanted to revisit all of his favorite adventures, but like published ones and remix them into a full campaign storyline. And I was very hesitant. I'm like, there's a lot of sharp edges on that game that I don't want to get snagged on. And he was like, here are some of my house rules. And he just filed off all the hard edges and was like, no, we're playing this fast and loose. And so I was like, I'm in. And we had a blast. We had a great time, super great storyline. And I had a lot of fun with that. But currently I'm not playing any D&D in name proper, the capital letters and everything.
Yeah. You're improving it out.
Yeah. My preferred style is a lot more fast and loose, which is probably not surprising to anyone.
No. Yeah. Say that's on point.
Yeah.
Totally non-interview question. Are you part of that improv group that practices at the Kittery Community Center on Tuesday nights?
The Stranger Than Fiction group?
I don't know.
Oh, because we see them. We are on a volleyball team and we pass the window where they're all improvising. I'm like, that looks so cool, but we're playing volleyball.
Every Tuesday, I'm like, is Ryan Paul in there? I don't know what he looks like.
That's probably Stranger Than Fiction. Not that they're the only one around, but I was a founding member of that group and I was with them for about 10 years. And then I went back to college and started doing Dorks and Dungeons. And, you know, the direction of the group, as is with Dorks and Dungeons, is sort of like, what does the current membership want to do? Mm. And I was like, I'm not really into what you guys want to do right now, which is not condemning it or anything. But I was like, our interests are going in different directions. There's new membership. They want to do this thing over here. I'm going to go do this other thing. You know, it was an amicable parting of ways. But they're great. I mean, there's members in that group who have been in there since I was there when we started it. You know, they have a long pedigree of great improvisers in that group, and they're just still kicking out great material and, you know, raising up good improvisers and sending them out into the world. Yeah, I have nothing but good things to say about them, but that's why you haven't seen me in there.
Yeah, we'll know.
Makes sense now.
Because Dorks and Dungeons rehearses on Tuesday nights, so we're, across town.
Oh, yeah. I see.
That makes sense.
It was all over a scheduling conflict. That's what it was.
How would one get into improv as far as would they join one of these improv groups, or are there like classes they should maybe start out with?
Yeah, it depends on, I guess, where you are. Like if you're near a major city, there's usually a theater dedicated to such things, and they're usually going to have some classes you can take. So that's a great way to get your feet wet and figure out if this is something you want to do. Yeah, we're near Boston, so it's very, you can go down to Boston, but Stranger Than Fiction teaches classes. So you can hit them up. I personally started doing it in high school. Then I went to UNH and got involved doing it over there. And that kind of got my feet wet. And then I dropped out of college for various reasons. And Stranger Than Fiction was starting up and was like, we're forming this group. We need members. And so I went over and auditioned and got involved there. And then from there, because I knew people, I knew when auditions were. So I just went to some general auditions and got into a whole bunch of shows of short length. And that was kind of how I did my training montage, was just auditioned for a bunch of little shows at a little theater and just dove in and was like, I'm going to go to rehearsal, you know, their rehearsals, and they're going to teach me there, you know, read some books. So I think that you can learn a lot by do some reading and then just try to dive in and join a group if you think that that's the way to go. But at larger theaters, probably down in Boston, you're going to have to take some classes and kind of get to know the people before you can really get into the shows. I don't know that as a fact. I don't mean make it sound like they're gatekeeping those shows, but that's kind of how they get to know the performers, because they've got much bigger crowds. Mm-hmm. And so they want to get to know you better before they put you up on a main stage show. So you're more likely to do a class, meet some people, form a smaller group, get onto a stage with a smaller group of people on like a, you know, a midweek night and kind of work your way up, which is sort of the path that I took. I just skipped over the classes because I didn't know there were classes in that way. I took some what are called master classes, which is just
fancy pants,
which is where you just go and take like a 4-hour seminar class and learn some improv. I did a little bit of that, but there are like, you know, 8-week classes where you go every week and do that. But by the time I realized that was a thing I could do, I had been performing at a capacity with, you know, where I was like, this would be a step backwards. I wouldn't need to do this unless I moved to Chicago and wanted to get involved in the scene. Something right. like that. I would start over and take some classes where it would be, you know, I'd have to do that to get to know the scene.
Right. That's really interesting. So I'm on Stranger Than Fiction's Facebook page, and I don't know when exactly this episode will be out, but they certainly have several events on their calendar for 2020, including an Improv 101 Improv Fundamentals class. So for folks who are in the area and might be interested in giving it a shot, that would be a good way to do it.
I would encourage you to check it out. Yeah, they know how to teach. They've got teachers on staff.
Would you ever consider doing that, Sarah?
I don't know.
It's one of those things I'm terrified of doing, too. But I would totally do with a friend. But it scares the heck out of me, just like playing music in public. But I do that sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I just suck it up. But I always wanted to do it. I wish I had done it in middle school or high school and gotten more comfortable. I feel like it would have helped me a lot in life.
Yeah. Your little, like, you know, spiel about being a fearful person and confronting it and getting more comfortable and coming up with coping mechanisms was very empowering, but I don't know if it was empowering enough.
I gotta go on my soapbox for a little longer.
What if we did it together? What if you did it with a friend? Would that help or
hurt? I'll take the class with you.
Yeah, right. You're like, great. I'm going to look stupid in comparison.
That's also, is at the basis, that's what we fear, is other people thinking we are stupid.
Yeah, so phase one of doing improv, usually, even at, you know, high-level improv, is that when you're getting ready to perform, you do warm-ups. One of the purposes of doing a warm-up is we're going to do a thing where we all look ridiculous in front of each other, because if I've already done this in front of these people I'll be on stage with, then whatever else we're going to come up with on stage is nothing. Is I've already gotten over my shame, right? You destroy your shame before you do the show. And I think that new improvisers aren't told that. You just go in and you do these weird warm-ups. And you're like, I don't know what the point of that was. And you're like subtly just killing your shame before we've even done scene work.
I love that.
That's brilliant.
And so when I'm teaching new improvisers, I just tell them up front. I'm like, I'm not going to sneak this in on you. We're going to do this to look ridiculous so that you have already embarrassed yourself in front of me. And I have done the same to you. And we can move on and just do some scenes.
So you hit rock bottom. Yeah. Can't get any lower than that.
You just get all that shame out of the way right out of the gate. And you do that even before a show. you'd all do a warm-up together to, like, get the rest of your shame out of the way.
Cute.
So,
I love it.
Yeah, that's really cool.
How do you get over the giggles? Laura and I blooper all over this podcast, and we just can't get back.
You just embrace the love. I mean, in Dorks and Dungeons, we just openly laugh.
Yeah, which I think it enhances it. It just, you're in on the joke, you know?
We're sort of like, there's no reason to hide it. We're already have a very thin fourth wall in that show. But in other, I guess, formats where that would be discouraged, the way you get over the giggles is that you're so in the moment and focused on what you're building with your other scene partner that you aren't thinking about the humor, right? The audience is kind of getting that as this side effect. And that sometimes it'll make you laugh when you hear them laugh, but that you're, you know, that's just not what you're thinking about. So that's how you kind of avoid having some giggles, is you're just, that's not even in your mind.
Can we do a double date, Dorks and Dungeons?
Yes. Oh, you're asking her. Okay.
Right. You can come too. Okay.
Are you going to be there?
Maybe. I don't know.
Like, you know, on the stage.
Maybe. I don't know. I'll sit one out. I'll just hang out with you guys. I'll give you a running commentary.
Oh my gosh. And we'll go out to eat afterwards. It'll be so fun.
It'll be a great time.
Yeah. Actually, you know, Jeff loves going. I'll tell you right now, any episode you guys have ever had where there's been a lot of fart jokes, my husband is dying, almost laying on the floor, laughing hysterically.
Isn't that all of the shows that we do?
It's pretty much most of them. But there was one where there was just repeated farts played like overhead. This was like a year and a half ago or something. And he was crying. He does not cry easy. He was just tears streaming down his face. And Aaron would love it too. So yeah,
I think that's definitely go. The best sales pitch I've heard for the show. I don't know. Do I need to say anything else to get people to come?
Aaron right now to tell Jeff. So our husbands are together right now. I'm texting Aaron right now to tell Jeff to tell him about it.
Occasionally they go out on a date when we're recording. It's adorable. That's good. Yeah.
So I think this is a good plan. Yeah. And I'll let everyone know that we need more fart jokes on the show.
More fart jokes. Or just keep the same amount. If they haven't gone down, you're not doing anything wrong.
I don't think they've gone down. I don't know. After you do enough shows, you don't clock it anymore. Yeah. You know? I'm like, I don't know. I don't know. Some things happened in the show. They said it was good, so we did a good job. Good job, everybody.
So we're going to go check it out. And how should other folks go check it out? Where do you guys play and how often?
So our routine is a monthly show. Usually it's like the last Friday of the month. But this month it's a Saturday because of the holiday. Everything's moving around. Mm. But I know.
That's great. My husband works on Fridays. How did you know?
I'm just real good.
I'm busy the last Saturday of the month.
We're going without you.
Okay, fine. Yeah, sorry.
I'm going to go without you.
We'll go on a suck.
Sorry.
What the heck, Brian?
I'm sorry.
Oh my gosh.
We arranged for our triple date, but now it's off. We perform at 3S Art Space in Portsmouth. It's a lovely space that people should check out. In general, they've got an art gallery. They have music and performing stuff there, which is really great. Usually a venue focuses on one or the other. Mm. And they try to cater to both, which is really cool. You can see a variety of stuff there. And they have some tacos next door.
They're delicious.
You know, I like them.
They are delicious.
So yeah, 3S Art Space is the place to see us.
Seasons? So the one that's coming up is season 8, episode 1?
Correct.
Tell me more. Like, let's say it was episode 2. Do I need to have seen the first one to understand what's going on?
It depends on, that's a tough question to parse.
Do you guys do like a light recap? Don't you?
It depends. This will be our 8th year, I guess. The first couple of years were like Seinfeld seasons where Seinfeld had like 4 episodes in season 1 and then they did like 6 and then they started doing normal seasons. We were like that where we had like 4 episodes in our season 1 and then we called it a season 2, but we only did 5 episodes. And so it's, yeah. In any case, this is all right. We're calling it our 8th season, and we change it up every year because we change up what we feel like doing. But we try to have some theme to each season of the show. And sometimes that theme is very in your face and obvious what we're trying to do. And other years, it's way more subtle and almost unstated that we're just kind of like, oh, we're just kind of playing with this theme and whatever. It changes with our moods. So you don't really need to see one episode to follow it to the next for most seasons. But I mean, I don't know, because I don't know what's going to happen in the first episode. So I can't say how important that'll be to episode two. Yes, everyone should go and see episode one, of course, and then come see episode two and, you know, be fully informed. But usually if there is a connecting plot element between two episodes, it is tenuous, and we will be like, yeah, there was like this important thing that happened. Anyway, moving on. We're not George R. R. Martin level of threads to keep track of. If there's a plot, big plot to keep track of, there's like one thread.
And so advice to the listeners, like, just risk it. It'll be funny either way.
Yeah. Yes. Cool. Yes. Don't worry. Pick it up wherever you want. You know, we try to have them be self-contained episodes that are nodding back to all the previous episodes for all the fans who are following along, so that we're trying to, you know, play to both ends of the spectrum, reward the longtime fans, and also make it accessible for just anyone off the street to jump in and try to follow along. Although, who knows how successful we are with that. But ideally, we're doing...
It's a good time either way.
It's a fun time, I think, either way. Yeah, you know?
Absolutely. So we're going to do one more regular question, and then we'll be doing rapid fire. Do you want to tell us about your history as a writer?
As a writer, my history as a writer. My history as a writer follows very closely with my history as an improviser.
That's good, because you don't have a lot of time.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. All right. That'll be the end of my answer.
We've already gone into rapid fire, actually. No. What do you write? What is your style like and your process like? Are you writing for theater or...
I started writing, I guess, at the drama club. They had a great director or, you know, parent organizer, whatever you want to call her, Linda. She brought some people in that teach us how to write. And we had like a weekend, you know, intensive of learning about writing plays. And I went and had a great time and wrote a ridiculous little play. And we then, as the drama club, you know, got other students to perform in them, so that whatever you wrote, you were not in, right? Mm. You got to kind of experience the process of giving it away to somebody else and having them produce it. And that was neat. And that kind of sparked my interest. And I wrote a teeny amount after that, but not a lot, just dabbling here and there. And then like years later, a friend of mine who's much more of a writer than I am, I went, let's co-write something, because that'll actually get me to get it done. Because, you know, it's a long process to write something, at least for most people. Some people are very fast. And so only a couple years ago, I went, let's write something and get it produced. And let's write a farce. What's a good elevator pitch so that we can easily tell people what our show is? So the pitch was that it's the Odd Couple on the Moon. And so,
yeah, I love that idea.
So the show is called Moonmates, Roommates on the Moon. And that
I love it already. I haven't even seen it.
And the writing process was that we would sit down and talk about like a idea, some like, this is the moment, the story moment we want to get across in this scene. And then we would open up a Google Docs, which everyone should be using because it's amazing, especially for collaboration. And you guys know.
Creative Guts is a firm believer in Google Docs.
Yeah. And so we would both log into the script documents we could write in it at the same time. And that we would just go back and forth writing dialogue for the characters and not necessarily saying much for a while, just the two of us kind of doing out a scene. And then we would go, oh, wait. And then we would switch who was writing which character and going back and forth. And then we just kind of went through the whole process like that. So it was super collaborative. Like, it's really hard for us to look at it and go, I wrote this line, you wrote that line. Mm. And then we would print it out on hard copy, go through, read it, mark it up. Just, this works, this doesn't work, we need this here. And then iterate through it. And that's kind of like my preferred way to do it is a lot like, somewhat like improv, in that we're being very collaborative, right? I'm trying to set you up, you're trying to set me up, we're trying to work together towards something. It's not any one person being the voice of all the good ideas, and the rest of us are just following along behind. And so that was really the process. And then we would mark it up, and then we would sit back down at the computer, type these things in, and go through that process again. We would read it, go, we need a scene here. This story beat isn't present. Right, like we have this upbeat, we have this downbeat, but we have too many downbeats in a row. We need some more upbeats in here. So let's go back and talk about what this needs, or do we want to rearrange these moments so that this is happening where we want it to happen, and trying to think about the story as, you know, a series of emotional ups and downs, and that being the unit, the chunks of a story. And then when we actually write, as we're writing dialogue, it's just very being silly, being our just, I think that the voice of us as writers is very apparent. I think if someone reads it, they went, oh, clearly you guys wrote this.
In a good way, right?
Yeah, in a good way. Like, that's just what you guys are like. Yeah, I wrote with Bretton Reese, who's, I think, known around here more as doing, like, theater tech and lighting and whatnot. But he's a super genius kind of guy who knows everything. And so he's great to collaborate with because I can bounce things off of his brain. And, you know, he'll always have something smart to say. Go, oh, great, yeah, we should do that. You know, and then he'll do the same to me, and I try to keep up.
If he wants to be on a podcast, go send him that form you filled out.
Oh, I will do that. I will let him know. Yeah, he would be great. You got, yeah, Bretton's great. Yeah.
And so what, God, we really got to get going, but I want to know what happened with Moonmates as far as, was it produced or is it in process?
So living? We originally wrote it to be pitched at the Players Ring because they have an open, anyone can pitch show process. It's really cool, but we did not get what we wanted out of that, because they have like this late night series for shorter plays, and our play was not that short, and so we were like, we can't do it. We're not going to cut this. This is very much a two act show. Blah blah blah. So we shelved it. We went back to work on it, and then some people at the Rochester Performing Arts Center was aware of this project that we had been working on, because we had pitched it. When you pitch it at the Players Ring, you're pitching it in front of everybody.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was known that this was a thing that existed. And so they contacted us and were like, we're going to start doing like full productions. So we got to kind of be like their first full production theater show in that space.
Oh, I wish we'd seen it. When was it?
Was it a year ago or so?
Oh,
Was it filmed?
No, it's theater.
Come on.
Well, we're going to be remounting it in around Memorial Day.
Cool. You need to send us info when it's happening.
I will
happening.
Let you know.
It's actually already in my calendar.
It's already in my calendar. Yeah, down at the Firehouse, what's their proper name? Firehouse Theater or something, that's in Newburyport.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I love that theater.
Yeah, it's a cool little space. I've only been there a handful of times. Yeah, I was not aware of it for a while.
We're going.
Yeah, we pitched, and they have a very busy schedule, but we have like a one weekend show that we'll be doing because, Brett and I were like, this show, you know, we should, it deserves another run. So the set and costumes and everything, when we were done, packed them up and put them in my basement and went, we'll come back to this. So they're taking up a lot of space, so we better get back to it.
Good. I'm very excited.
That's awesome.
Your elevator pitch made me very happy.
Yeah.
So
I am pleased with the final product.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, sometimes I've done projects and gone, that was ridiculous, but I did it. This is one where I'm definitely pleased with the results. So I'm excited to go back to it.
And kudos again to the Rochester Performance and Arts Center, who gets kudos on this show.
Yeah.
Every episode, it seems.
Pretty much. Yeah. Since Matt Wyatt, it's been.
Well, kudos to them.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. They took a gamble on, you know, this show that had never been. So it was our world premiere for their Aww. Opening of the space. It was really cool.
That's so great.
And a couple people showed up. So it was great for that, too. People actually came and saw it.
That's awesome.
We need to go to rapid fire questions now, where we will ask you questions that are no surprise. You need to answer rapidly.
I will try to be less verbose than I usually am.
Accents. Do you like performing them? And if so, what's your favorite one to do?
Not really into doing accents. I think that in improv, it's usually a waste of my mental energy.
That was an answer that means I'm not good at accents. It's okay. I get it.
You are correct. I don't disagree with you. I'm not good at accents.
What's your favorite color?
Green.
Favorite scent?
Sawdust.
That's mine too.
That's a good one.
Oh, that's weird.
Favorite sound?
Do I have to make the sound?
Only if you want to. No. That was a first.
I think that the Foley work for the Ghostbusters film is phenomenal, and the sound of the proton packs is pleasing to my ear. We also sneak some of those into Moonmates.
That's awesome. Oh, that's really cool. Who's is it? You?
No, it's you.
Oh, favorite texture?
Flannel, I guess. That's what I'm wearing right now. I'm going to go with that.
Most inspiring location you've ever traveled to?
Wellington, New Zealand. I'm even wearing a shirt. I can't see it. My cool. T-shirt.
Yeah. Oh, very cool.
Looking cool.
What is your favorite character that you've played?
Wow. Because I've played a lot as an improviser. I had a lot of fun playing Thorax, the hologram. It was a challenging role. I really got a kick out of doing that for our Geeks and Galaxies show.
If you could go back in time, what advice would you give your younger self?
That there's a long list.
I think that noise summed it up really well.
maybe pertaining to creativity.
Right. Yeah. Well, watch out for that fender bender. You know, invest in Apple. I think creatively, I would have told myself, learn more about being a self-motivator, because that's a thing I still need to work on and learn to do. I work better collaboratively, mm-hmm. and I'm weak when I'm solo. And so getting an earlier start on that, of that realization, would have been useful to know.
That's a great answer.
Yeah, it is. Brian, thank you so much
for being
on Creative Cuts.
That was exciting.
This was a pleasure. This was really fun to talk to. And almost everyone we talk to, I want to do the thing they're doing after I'm done talking to them. And this is a big case. Like, I want to go do it. Do I have the guts to? I don't know, but I want to.
The other half of Creative Guts. The guts. Ugh. The guts.
You guys could do it. You guys could do it.
You got a lot of guts.
Oh, I passed the test. Is that this is the end of the interview?
As Becky Barcy would say, you've been gutted. You've been on the show. So to wrap it all up,
show us your creative guts.
Another huge thank you to Brian for joining us on the Creative Guts podcast. Holy cow, that was awesome. I want to do improv now, even though I'm terrified. But he was just so darn fun to talk to. Another person I want to be friends with now.
I will make doing improv a life goal. Someday I will get up the courage. Maybe it'll be my retirement plan or something. But that was so fun.
That was wicked fun.
It was really fun.
And I learned so much about how you can use improv in your life. I loved that part when he was talking about the status of a situation with a person and whether you can use that to make them feel better or not.
Me too. It was such an interesting lesson in psychology, and he was so well-spoken about it. It was really cool.
Yeah. Thank you again, Brian. That was awesome. We definitely want to have you back on the show.
Yeah. If you want to check out Dorks and Dungeons, you can find them online, dorksanddungeons.com. They're also on Facebook, and I'll let you figure out the rest of the social media from there.
And as per usual, we'll have a lot of links and more on our Facebook page, facebook.com/creativegutspodcast.
Our Instagram handle is Creative Guts Podcast, so if you're not already there, go find us.
Yeah. And our website is creativegutspodcast.com. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll be back next Wednesday with another episode of Creative Guts.
The man with three first names.
Yep.
Well, what is your middle name?
It's Edward.
Edward.
Oh, I just
wasn't paying attention.
Okay, let's start over from the top.
I'm glad I'm editing this one. I was focusing on my great joke of Smith as a middle name.
It's so good. No, that's a really good, top quality.
We all laughed because it was such a good joke.
Yeah.
And they have some tacos next door.
They're delicious.
You know, I like them.
They are delicious.
So yeah, 3S Art Space is the place to see us.
And I love that you can fill out your taco on this beautiful little sheet that's just very organized and, you know, just go for the formatting of the taco form.
I think it's a great system as well.
Yeah. We're done with you now, and now we're talking about Barrio. This is a different podcast.
I can talk about Barrio, too. Don't worry. I'm here. I'm here for that.
Show us your creative guts.
You were going to say it. I almost screwed it up.
Did you screw it up?
I almost screwed it up.
Yeah, but we played it off, so it was good. Yeah. We did the improv thing.
Fine. I did the improv thing.
She inhaled. She went,
and I choked back smiled. The giggles. It was fine. It's all good.
Because when we do our Creative Catalog episodes, we we'll just say, and with that, and then we both say it because it's just us two.
Yeah, we don't need the count to three.
We count with a guest to be nice.
It's been a rough day.
Appreciate you guys giving me the layup there with the counting.